Many Americans think of Italian opera, Shakespearean plays, and classical music as highbrow culture. But cultural historian Lawrence Levine says these art forms only took on their elite image at the turn of the century. Levine is the author of Highbrow, Lowbrow, an historical analysis of how Americans started differentiating between high and low culture. Levine says the terms highbrow and lowbrow were brought into the language by 19th century phrenologists, who argued that people who had high brows, that is, a lot of space between their eyebrows and their hairlines, had more space for their brains, and so the argument went, highbrowed people were more intelligent. The theory never caught on in modern science, but Levine found that the terms highbrow and lowbrow, when applied to culture, stuck. Levine teaches at the University of California at Berkeley and is also a former MacArthur Fellow. His new book came out of research he was doing on minstrel shows. He found that Shakespeare was frequently parodied. He concluded that Shakespeare's plays had popular followings in the 19th century. Otherwise, how would the minstrel audiences have gotten the jokes?
You know, Shakespeare was called the Bird of Avon, and he was the most popular playwright in 19th century America, attended by all classes, played on stages in which there was also a great deal of popular entertainment, gymnastics and sword swallowing and popular songs and declamations. I wondered how typical he was, so I delved into other areas of what we now call high culture, opera, fine arts, symphonic music, to see how they were depicted in 19th century America, and I found very much the same picture. Opera, for instance, which has ironically become the very epitome of effete high-class culture in the popular mind. If you look at movies like the Marx Brothers' Night at the Opera, opera was one of the most popular mediums of music throughout the 19th century. It was sung and whistled and played, and people attended it, and it was done in English, and it was also accompanied by many different forms and genres of popular entertainment, so that the 19th century presented a very different kind of cultural picture than our own century.
Well, you really conclude that a lot of the differentiations we make between highbrow and lowbrow, or between the fine arts and the popular arts, have more to do with class than with art.
Oh, I think they do. They have to do with class, and they have to do with a sense of order. When the word culture, with a capital C, was first used in the decades after the Civil War, Walt Whitman, the poet, was very disturbed, and he said culture is not something for boardrooms and libraries. Culture is something for people. And he looked to the new middling classes, those with bank accounts and homes, to turn to the workers and create a democratic culture with the working classes that would represent America. But in fact, what I think happened is that those upper middle classes that were newly formed when America became an industrialized modern country looked, in fact, to the gentry and the elite, as did the new plutocrats, and formed their cultural notions there, so that our schools and colleges became fixated upon this notion of something higher that was removed from everyday life. Industrialization is a disorderly process, and there was a quest and a craving for order. And that sense of disorder, that is, the crowds in theaters were multi- class crowds. They didn't always act the way the gentry wanted them to. They would riot, they would throw things, they would yell, they would interfere if they didn't like the way the play was going. And what happens is that order is imposed. The first thing you do is you fragment. You begin to remove certain things from the popular theater, and then you insist on a certain sense of decorum. Even among the classes, there was a sense that we could enter the theater late, leave it early, talk when we wanted to. The Metropolitan Opera in the 1890s had to post signs in the boxes asking people not to make noise because they were disturbing the opera singers. I mean, the turn of the century was a time when order was imposed on culture everywhere.
You use the expression the sacralization of culture. In what way do you think that culture was made sacred? What do you mean by that expression?
If you think Shakespeare was a playwright, a great one, but just a playwright, then you can modify his plays. If you think he made mistakes, you can cut pieces out. You can change endings. I mean, this was done throughout the 19th century. But if you think Shakespeare was a sacred purveyor of great art, then he can't be touched. You can't interpret him. You can't do anything to him at all. In fact, you have to, because playing Shakespeare is a matter of interpretation. But to make something sacred is to remove it from the human realm. So if Mozart is sacred, as he was not in his own day, then you can never do anything to Mozart but play him the way you think he wanted to be played, whatever that means, because it's not clear how he wanted to be played. But that's what happens. The artists become so sacralized that no one is supposed to be able to touch their music.
Is there any, like, one moment in history you can isolate as an example of how the highbrow, lowbrow separation started coming into play, how people started to make a difference between, you know, the popular arts, which weren't as good, and the fine arts, which were more edifying?
Let me tell you a quick anecdote about the early 1870s, when the great Edwin Booth was playing Richard II, and a clerk named Mark Gray was sitting with the play on his lap, and he saw Booth making many changes in the play, and he pulled out a gun and tried to kill Booth. He missed him, shot at him twice. And the point was that Booth was murdering Shakespeare, and I have the right to kill Booth. The notion that this is, for me, a mark of the sacredness of Shakespeare, that he had become an actor, he had become a cultural symbol that no one could tamper with any longer.
American artists have lived in the shadow of European mm-hmm. artists, and this is mm-hmm. especially true for contemporary classical composers, yeah. for opera composers as well, mm-hmm. I think to a certain degree for dancers. How does what you found historically help explain the raising of European culture and the looking down upon yeah. American art?
Well, the American Revolution was a cultural, was a political and economic event, but it wasn't a cultural event. And culture, especially the kind of cultural bifurcation split I'm talking about in this book, where you get high and low culture, it was very Eurocentric. It worshipped Europe. Art was European. The great music was European. We didn't have a native-born conductor of a symphony orchestra in this country for a very long time, because the notion seemed to be an oxymoron. You can't have a great conductor who's native-born. You can't have a great conductor composer who's not European.
At the end of the book, you say that you read Alan Bloom's book, The Closing of the American Mind, and that his arguments about, you know, preserving culture reminded you of the warnings at the turn of the century. Explain the comparison.
Well, what's happened to American culture in our own time in the last 20 years is, as I said before, it's opening up again. We're certainly not living in an age of cultural ecumenicism yet, but the lines are less rigid. I gave some examples of a moment or two ago. I think this, for instance, in my own discipline, history, we no longer just teach the history of military and political leaders. We're now beginning to look at the history of the folk. We're interested in popular entertainment as well as high culture, and we teach that in our courses. This is threatening. It's threatening to people like Bloom. In his book, Bloom says that classical music was the only class distinction America had. The only way of separating the high class from the low class was a love of classical music. And he sees that now no longer being perpetuated in the kids, and he's very upset. To him, rock music is junk. It's music for the bad part of the human being. It's like the drug traffic. He makes direct analogies with all of these things. Anything that says other parts of culture are worth respect and looking at and even teaching in universities and schools is a threat to the sense of cultural order he has. You see, if I can just make one remark, which I think explains a lot, if one insists on looking at culture vertically, then there's only one top, and you have to fight very hard to keep that at the top. If one can look at culture horizontally, that is, place things next to one another, not necessarily because they're of aesthetically the same worth, but because one can compare them that way. If one can, then you have a center in which things can touch and mix and can be compared. I like to look at culture horizontally. Bloom and others look at it in a strict vertical fashion, and they're fighting very hard for their place at the top of that hierarchy, and it's too bad. I think it's a very bad and silly way to look at culture.
You're a university professor. How well is this argument accepted, do you think, among academics?
Not very well. Much better than when I was a student. And there are many more courses and much more receptivity on the part of students. But I also think there isn't enough of it. I think there are still too many professors clinging to this old hierarchical notion. The products, this is going to be very unpopular with my colleagues, but it's true, and I say it a lot. The products of bad education have difficulty recognizing good education. And many of us are the products of very bad education in this sense.